We're going through something absolutely historic.
Technologies across the board are growing exponentially.
It's a disruption that's going to completely redefine the way businesses compete.
In the next decade, we're going to lose 40% of today's Fortune 500 companies.
The exponential growth of computing is continuing.
AI is nowhere near its full potential.
Whether you like it or not, that the future cannot be stopped by anyone.
So welcome back to another episode of the Future Tech and Foresight podcast. As always, I'm your host, Mark Verbenkoff. So over the past, say, 6 months or so, I've had a number of podcast episodes specifically focusing on AI and, of course, going into more depth on generative AI, as this is the technology that is kind of taking the world by storm. But I would say most of these episodes tend to focus on the more theoretical aspects of what generative AI will eventually be able to do by looking at some of the things that it can do now, but really extrapolating how much better the technology will be and what it can do in the next 5 to 10 years. And though this is personally, I think, very interesting, very exciting, and kind of gets everybody in a sense of anticipation for what this technology will be able to do, I think that there's still real value into looking at what applications can be done practically today. And that hasn't been focused on the podcast all that much, so I'm really happy to have my guest today, Jorge Davila Chacon, talk about the actual practical applications of AI. So we dive into the kind of art of pinpointing the right business facets for AI integration and really ponder over the feasibility of retrofitting existing projects with AI components. So Jorge shares invaluable insights on the essential considerations for integrating AI into businesses and offers a real firsthand account of a number of projects where AI played an actual pivotal role in doing so. We also dive into exciting comparisons between the emergence of generative AI tools and bespoke AI systems. And I think that this is a really important part of the discussion because so much focus has been given to the generative AI tools that are out there, but there are really powerful and practical and useful applications of these other type of AI systems that I don't think have been getting as much focus as they deserve over especially the last, say, 6 to 8 months since ChatGPT really burst onto the scene. And of course, finally, we more or less end the conversation on peering into the future of AI, and we get Jorge's specific take on how businesses might be adopting artificial intelligence tools and systems in the next years to come. So who is Jorge? He is an expert in designing and executing machine learning and AI systems across diverse data types, including sequential decision-making, text, audio, and visuals. He's the co-founder of Helden Combinat Technologies in Germany. He spearheads industry-specific AI solutions and serves as a lecturer at the Hamburg School of Business Administration. Among his notable achievements is the co-authoring business guide Scoping Machine Learning Projects and collaboration with the award-winning project Convergence, which gained the 2021 top honor at Prix Art Electronica. Jorge has engaged with prominent institutions such as MIT, CNRS in France, KTH in Sweden, and the University of Hyderabad. Recognized for his contributions, he reviews for esteemed journals and has chaired committees for the ICANN Conference on Artificial Neural Networks. For an in-depth look at Jorge's projects and publications, you can visit his company website, heldencombinat.com. And of course, I'll have that up in the show notes. Hi there, Jorge. Thank you very much for coming on to the podcast today.
Great. Thank you very much for the invitation, Mark. Very happy to join you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think we mentioned the previous time that we talked, you know, a lot of the podcast episodes are focused on maybe more theory or ideas of what's going on. And I think today it's going to be a lot of like practical applications and how these specifically artificial intelligence applications are actually being taken up by companies. So it's a little bit of a different theme, but still within the general topic of the podcast. And I'm really looking forward to hearing what you have to say about this.
Very happy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the way I start every podcast is to ask how you got interested in, I mean, artificial intelligence engineering, which is what you do, but maybe how you initially got interested in artificial intelligence to begin with.
True. No, that's a very good question. I think also for this, these moments, because so many different people are joining the field of AI. Really, you don't need to have a very concrete computer science background to feel like interested in the topic and join and find lots of really interesting opportunities. So in my case, basically, I'm coming from engineering, mechanical engineering, and so I've always been interested in the applied side of things, right? On the technology. And not only on the science later on, then I jumped on the scientific side. I moved from Mexico to the Netherlands and started studying very concretely AI. I was very fortunate to find back then one of the few places that were giving 2009 degrees in AI itself. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So to me, that was really exciting because normally one would go to the computer science path or engineering path and specialize in one field, for example, computer vision, pattern recognition, and so on. Mm-hmm. And in this place in the Netherlands, actually in Groningen, it was a really beautiful program. It still is there because then one could learn a little bit of many things. That's one of the things I really love from this program. So you go and dive a little bit into linguistics, biology, neuroscience, robotic, sound processing, all a little bit of many things. And so that was actually the one thing that really pulled me there after my bachelor. Mm-hmm. And finally, I did my PhD in Germany, but more focused on the neuroscience side of things. So I went a bit more into biology, the neural computation, how we actually do all these perception action processes in our brain. Mm-hmm. And funny enough, by the end of that, I found out that all these studies or learning in robotic systems is a really, really great playground to understand many problems that currently exist in the industry. So with this, what I mean is, for example, you have to understand what to do when you have constant streams of information. Mm. So you have to process and learn on the fly. Or maybe also you want to solve a problem, not just with one modality, let's say text or audio, but you want to start integrating different modalities and solve apparently like vision problems, mm-hmm. but actually by integrating sound in them or song. So this was a really interesting like discovery on my side. And that's what kind of brought me back to the engineering side of things.
Right, right. And that led you to start or co-found a company where you're actually helping organizations implement AI before the generative AI boom happened, right? So you were already in AI right. before then. Yeah, which I think is great, right? Because as you mentioned, there's so much focus on artificial intelligence nowadays, but that's only within, I guess, really the last 8-10 months or something like that. But there's been a substantial amount of, you know, obvious AI implementation for a number of years. So why don't we dive into it a little bit, specifically with relation to implementing or adopting AI systems into companies. So I guess one of the first questions I have here is, how do you identify a project or an application for a business, right? Because it's not just AI can be used for everything. Very soon, maybe in the next couple of years, but currently and in the near past, it's probably very specific things. So maybe you can touch on that to start off.
Yeah, definitely. In this respect, we actually found that it was one of the crucial aspects for us. As a little company starting, you know, to dive into AI applied in the industry, because it's not so straightforward to understand where you can really benefit from this technology as a like a company in many different industry sectors. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But if you really don't do it correctly, there is a risk that you really it drains you a lot of resources. So, and this is dangerous because later on you can, you know, end up feeling frustrated, confused, believing this is actually helping or working for you. And we had a lot of conversations with different industry directives, and particularly my co-founder, Olaf Eriksson. I mean, his background is in business. And we tried to formulate this question very concretely. And a term we came up with is this machine learning imperative. So it starts becoming a little bit philosophical, but basically it's taking this concept, right? From Kant, where you try to define the machine learning problems that really are worth it to pursue in the industry, as those problems where it is not just a good solution, but it's like the solution. Like if you don't do it in this way, it really would be senseless. And this is helping a lot to constrain very early on the ideas that companies may have of where to start applying AI. So this is a very hard cut, but at the beginning it really has helped a lot for making things clear on what we have seen.
Yeah, I can imagine people that or businesses that might not be dealing with AI or advanced technologies every single day. They just hear the idea of artificial intelligence. I can apply it everywhere for all my things, and it can solve all my problems, right? So I guess one of the main things that you're doing is helping to clarify, or as you said, condense. You know, it's this specific vertical that this business can actually use AI.
Correct.
I know that you're under a couple NDAs and you can't necessarily describe in depth. Is there maybe one example that you can give about, like, specifically this is where an AI can be actually utilized?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, I mean, there is more than one example. I could, like, talk a little bit more in detail. But maybe... one that I found particularly interesting, because we were able to apply this technology in different domains, was to understand how you could use biologically inspired computer vision models, integrating different types of information within one modality, this is vision, to solve very different, apparently different problems. So with this more concretely, what I mean is we design an interface where you could give it photos or documents, for example, with text and tables and images inside the documents themselves, and really bring meaning out of all this highly unstructured data. Particularly, for example, we were working with telco. We were working also with the automotive industry, and we were working with the energy service industry. And in all these cases, this same model helped them to solve little problems here and there, or sometimes even problems at the core of their business. So, for example, sometimes they just need to process a lot of invoices, but they're just so large corporates that this becomes actual like an issue for them. And in the side of the technology, what we found very useful is, for example, to understand in our brains we have something called the what and where visual pathways. So you go to the so-called dorsal and ventral pathway systems, and this helps you to understand when you're looking at the world, to understand what is that you are seeing. And funny enough, this is processed close to the language regions in our brain. So you can kind of articulate the meaning of what you see there. But you also want to see or understand the where. Because sometimes the useful information we have is often in a region of our visual space. So it's often above or below or in the middle. And these things really help a lot. So, for example, when you process a table of content, you often tend to have the totals in the bottom or in the bottom right.
Right.
So yeah. By integrating these two kind of streams of information, even though they are both visual, they are very different in terms of the meaning they convey. But by integrating them, we're able to start solving problems that otherwise would have been much more challenging with the technology like that was common back then.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's super interesting. I guess maybe a connected question to that is, so you're providing solutions kind of at a maybe a first time solution that these guys are looking for AI. Were they using previous like digital systems to try and solve this? And if so, was it more challenging to implement an AI solution on top of an already like previous attempted solution? Or is it easier? I would assume it would be easier to just start from scratch and like, okay, we're just going to start from scratch, build from the ground up with AI as the actual solution.
Yeah. Great point. Great point. Because indeed, that makes a big difference. So sometimes it's just not possible to build or rebuild something from the ground up. So you have to kind of slowly integrate, gradually. But it's also not very healthy or helpful to just like sprinkle with AI an existing like system. But sometimes really you have no choice. However, of course, whenever it's possible to start from the beginning to build a whole product around AI, you know, to have an AI-centered product, that helps a lot because, sort of say, because the body of the AI. So very often we tend to think of AI as the cognitive part of a system, the brain, the processing of this information. But these brains, similar to our brains, need sensors and actuators, right? Need eyes, and they also need hands. And this is actually the part that takes the longest to build correctly. And whenever you have an existing system, sometimes it's hard to really make sure not only that you are giving eyes and hands to your system if necessary, but also that the system is ready to have further sensors and actuators in the future. So that is future proof for whatever new data is going to come later on that you know will improve the performance, the accuracy of your system. So that's, I would say, one way of describing why is it better to really start from the bottom up if possible.
And have there, like, I'm assuming you've tried to, let's use the word like retrofit, right? So you have this digital solution, try to implement an AI solution on top of it. Does this digital solution really get in the way? Like, do you have to tear that down and then start from scratch? Or is it possible to, as you said, maybe sprinkle on or retrofit the digital solution? I know that it's easier, as you explained, to do it from scratch, but I'm just also curious on the other side.
It is possible. I mean, of course, it is possible. Another way also to describe it, when it is useful, I mean, this is connecting very nicely with the previous question, when it is useful to use AI for solving a problem, for creating value in a company, is this so-called two directions for forward and backward integration in your services. Mm-hmm. So whenever you really want to take over a service that you currently were being provided, you know, or to go further and then start automating something that your clients normally were doing themselves or getting from somewhere else. And this is good because you are in the first case, you are actually reducing costs. That means you're taking away a soup service from your current providers. And in the other case, it's good because you're creating new revenue streams.
Right.
Right. And in these two cases, you can always see this as little projects or mini internal products that yes, you are integrating with your existing systems, but at the same time, you are actually building them from scratch. Mm-hmm. Now, whenever it's possible to do this, if you don't have like a monolithic system in your corporation or so on, this helps a ton. Otherwise, it's also possible to try to really understand what are the little bits here and there where you can automate cognitive processes, which, by the way, to me, this is also a fascinating like a discovery we have early on. Particularly me coming from engineering, from mechanical engineering. I remember back when I was finishing my bachelor in mechanics, we were doing like some social services. So at some point I was working in a robotic automation company for a few months. And there, for example, I understood that this company was basically able to help their clients to automate let's call it manual labor, mm-hmm. by going into their factories, seeing their whole like processes, the production lines and so on. And then they were able to say, this little bit here, we can automate with a robotic arm, or here we just need a simple actuator pushing a box from left to right or so on. Mm-hmm. And at the end, they would help them in this way. And I started understanding that this is very similar to what happens with AI, but in the sense that we are not solving now any more manual jobs or labor with robotic hardware, but we are solving now mental labor or tasks with robotic software. Mm. The challenge there is that very often it's easier to open the doors of your company and show your internal processes to engineers with the hardware, not always, but very often, than the internal document or strategic processes. That tends to be much, much more sensitive often. Mm. And companies tend to be reluctant to just show everything on their internal processes to these consultants or engineers and so on. And that makes it a little bit harder to help them understand where is the best places to use automation to create value, to solve problems and so on. It's not impossible though, of course. And there's always different approaches. You can end up basically focusing not only on doing like a product that you sell to them, but to help their internal teams build together with you this product, learn how to maintain it, and take over most of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you touched on that. That was actually going to be my follow-up discussion, my follow-up question with regards to how, I guess you call it like senior management or, the CEO or board, compared to staff and employees about the acceptance of the adoption and implementation of these technologies. When I was working in Europe, one of the large projects that I was involved in was bringing collaborative robotics, right? So ones with sensors and they're able to be aware of a human in, say, a machine or a factory setting, so they can stop and slow down and then stop so they don't hit people. But there was of course, a big push to have this technology implemented by the senior level management, because there might be some efficiency gains that would be achieved. There would be increased profitability margins, but the staff was thinking immediately, oh shit, robotics, artificial intelligence, well, my job's going to go away. So You already touched on one aspect of how people are pushing back by not giving kind of the internal processes and data. How have you experienced the staff, maybe at both the lower and the higher levels within these businesses that you've been consulting with?
Cool. Yeah, that is certainly a challenge there. It can even vary in in intensity in different industry sectors. So, for example, like the more common scenario we have found is that these are very new technologies. And of course, it makes sense that not everybody has a deeper expertise in them. But they're very powerful because you don't need to be a domain expert in an industry to already be able to solve problems that normally domain experts tend to struggle a lot. And when you normally enter into these discussions, you tend to start the discussions with the technical leads. And it's always very interesting to understand with them, to talk with them, but there is often, I believe, a bit of a skepticism or a certain reprehension to go further, because they this could have consequences for them. Maybe it's even more of a misperception also on their side, because so far I have not witnessed any like reduction in technical personnel and so on. But because of this, normally this project used to stagnate often. So something that helps a lot there is to, even though it's a highly technical topic, constantly have communication with the executives.
Right.
With the, because for them, on the other hand, what matters most is really the value you're creating for the company. And this helps more to have this. Of course, I completely understand the concerns of the people on the technical teams and so on. Now, this being said, for example, we also witness a deeper concern in certain sectors, which is, for example, in the medical industry. Because often there you have that the decision makers, the executives, C-level people, are often medical doctors themselves. And no one likes that, you know, some people come and tell you, hey, guys, like, we have a technology that works as well as, you know, human experts in medicine in this and these tasks. So, of course, one also has to be careful in the way one communicates the capabilities of the system. And help people understand that this is not about replacing them, right? This is always about helping them to potentiate their existing capabilities, to scale and grow.
That's interesting. It's also some of the similar discussions that we had to have with the employees of some of these companies for the robots. So glad to hear that there's some similarities there. So you touched before, you mentioned before about, you know, some of these AI solutions that you bring to companies can, you know, really get to the core of the company itself. Again, with the examples that you can speak about, can you maybe touch on the successes that maybe one or two of the successes? It doesn't have to be necessarily the core one, but if you can talk about that one, of course, that'd be quite interesting as well.
Yes. No, this brings to mind one of the most impressive ones from my perspective was, and this also publicly, like public information, for a project I had actually before I joined my co-founder in our consulting firm. I used to work in what they call a company builder from a corporate here in Germany. And basically, this is a large conglomerate, and they have a lot of daughter companies. And they found that they often had shared pain points between different daughter companies. So instead of just bringing people to help them solve these pain points, they thought about creating startups around these pain points, test all these ideas internally, and if it was working well, create spin-offs. So this was a fantastic idea. One of these projects was about debt collection. So you basically just try to help people, you know, recover these outstanding invoices and so on. You want to help people that normally would not have access to these services, which are normally only reserved for large companies. You wanted that everybody also would have access to these services, even if you are a very like a micro entrepreneur. So it was actually a really, really nice idea. And interestingly enough, in the initial projections, the expectation was to be able to recover the first, I think the target was €1 million in recovery in around 2 years, you know, step by step. And around 10 months, they already had doubled this. So everybody was a bit surprised, of course. But it was a very nice surprise. Also interesting to know this was not a purely AI system. It was a hybrid system combining this technology, but also humans in the loop. Okay. And I think it also was a very, very interesting experience for the clients themselves, because back then we're very fortunate to be one of the few people to be allowed to put reinforcement learning models in production. And the big difference with reinforcement learning and other type of machine learning approaches is that you cannot really learn much, not as an algorithm, from historical data per se. In these cases, you really need to use real-time customer interactions for the system to learn. So, of course, and understandably, many clients were not very keen to give you, I don't know, 10% of their portfolio to train a system. Because there's a huge risk from their perspective. They don't know this technology. And furthermore, they were even told in advance that the expectation is that the revenue would actually go down at the beginning with the promise that they would go much higher after. So luckily for everyone, this worked very well. And it was very, very, also very interesting experience for us.
Good, good. I think some of the people listening would be curious as to the price of some of these systems. I don't know if you can give a rough range. Also because I think when we're talking about, you know, maybe non-generative AI technologies or non-generative AI solutions, like the first thing that comes to my mind would be like these large AI systems that, you know, beat the world chess grandmaster, or, you know, some of these like larger, maybe more historical ones that that have been a little bit more publicized. So I'm sure that there's a range from like a small solution to a large solution. But if you care to, and if you can, I think it'd be valuable for some of the audience members to just hear like a rough price range. Yeah.
Interestingly enough, the costs have decreased exponentially. Like really what would require a full-fledged project 4 years ago, now is like an integrated service in most of the cloud service providers. Like you just need an engineer to put up the data and that's it. So this is fantastic. But in general, it's I think highly contextual.
Yeah, of course.
For example, do you already have an existing team of engineers that only need some guidance, or do you need someone to really help you build end to end this product? Does it? Like, is it the case that your use case falls within the use cases that the cloud service providers are interested in? Because then you like won the lottery. It's already really, really cheap. Or do you require a customized solution? In this case, for example, you could approach small, like, boutique style providers that would react very quickly to your request. You have very frequent direct communication, but sometimes for different reasons, People in larger companies prefer to approach other large companies to provide their very same service. It sounds a bit extreme, but for the very, very same service that you would maybe, I don't know, require 100, 200,000 euros, they end up paying dozens of millions of euros. They know they don't have to, but due to their context, it actually makes sense for them to do this. So they have these strategic partnerships and so on.
Right, right.
So even for very, very similar services, you may end up paying completely different prices.
Yeah.
So, but ultimately, I think in this also connects to other topics we were discussing before. This is one of the bright sides, I think, of the future of AI, that later on, you don't even need to think about bringing experts. Like, basically, you want that teenagers in their bedrooms can play with this technology and start doing like crazy cool things themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's get into that, because that's certainly one of my favorite discussions. Not teenagers in the bedrooms implementing AI, but the future of this technology and how it's going to be utilized, right? So as I mentioned to you off the recording, I'm starting to build a company right now, and I'm utilizing some simple AI tools, but they're very profound and they're very useful for the things that I'm able to implement. You know, you said over the course of some 4 years or so, the exponential drop in cost of implementing some of these AI tools has already happened. But maybe just before we get into that, of course, you're talking about reinforced learning, and there's this hype wave, it's probably going to continue, about generative AI.
Yeah.
I think there's obviously some overlap there, but do you see this exponential cost drop for reinforcement learning continuing, or is it now being taken up by generative AI, and there's the future is going to be more focused on generative AI than reinforced learning and these other kind of AI models?
Mm-hmm. Now, that's interesting. Well, basically, maybe a useful way to put it is, reinforcement learning as a technology to solve your problems, well, as a business, you know, can help you solve so-called sequential decision problems. Mm-hmm. So things that involve time, multiple interactions today, tomorrow, the day after. And depending on what happens in this sequence, you make different decisions. This makes these algorithms more challenging, because you actually cannot fully automate their deployment or their design as other types of neural networks that you say, okay, I have a computer vision like related model, and it doesn't matter what I want to detect. It can be animals, it can be cars, it can be whatever. I just upload different data and it learns the same. With reinforcement learning, it is always very close to the domain. So you need to understand what kind of rewards you want to give your system that are related to, I don't know, the discovery of new proteins, to play a board game or so on. Now, the connection between reinforcement learning and generative AI is a bit more in the background.
Mm-hmm.
People using generative AI don't use reinforcement learning themselves, but the people offering generative AI can, in some cases, use reinforcement learning to train their generative AI models.
Right.
Particularly in language models, where you want to kind of clean a little bit the kind of answers that you get and so on. So in this case, I think even though reinforcement learning tend to be more expensive implementations of AI, for the users of generative AI products, they will not notice this. So even if you pay for these services in images, in text, and so on, the costs will still be exponentially smaller as time passes. Already now, it's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Oof, really, it's unbelievable. Like with the largest computers that you do need to train or to refine these models to your use case, you're paying cents per hour right now with service providers. And just a few years ago, it was you really needed like servers, literal supercomputers by definition in your home to solve the same things. And now you just, you know, you get free credits as a startup and you start.
Yeah. It's absolutely fascinating. I've been trying to pay attention to the changes as much as I possibly can. Also because my clients want to know about it too, right? So they're you know, working in very, very different industries, and they're excited about the potential. Maybe we can look, or I can get your perspective on like the next couple of years with this price drop, right? Little companies like mine, you know, some of my clients are a lot smaller. There's only like, you know, 10 people or so. It's going to be more and more feasible for them to take on some of these solutions, isn't it? Whether generative AI or otherwise. How do you, what kind of impacts do you think that's going to happen? Maybe at a micro scale and a macro scale, like will society just, or will industries just be completely revolutionized by this? We've been hearing a lot about this in like, you know, YouTube videos or headlines, but like you're actually working in the industry directly. So, you know, what are your perspectives on this?
Yes, we already were seeing very interesting phenomenon. For example, back in this company where I mentioned I was working earlier, even already there, then these technologies were so powerful to help small teams scale a service that rather than creating a project internally within one of these daughter companies or bringing us together, it was far more efficient to just ignore for a little bit the fact that you already own a company that solved this particular problem and just create a completely new one, fully centered on AI, and let them compete.
Crazy.
And what one can kind of extrapolate out of this is that basically now it's going to be much, or it can be much easier for many newcomers to start competing with the, you know, the large companies that are having them for a long time, which hopefully will lead to a healthier market, right?
Yeah.
There are, of course, certain risks involved in there, because sometimes, the systems can end up solving problems in ways that you don't anticipate. And you don't necessarily see this if you are only paying attention to certain like KPIs. For example, there could be a risk that if you are working in debt collection, an algorithm finds that if you only care about maximizing revenue, maybe for certain profiles that it defines through these interactions, is more profitable to not help people remember they have to pay. If you know this person has high probability of paying interests.
Mm.
And that's really not cool. You are not supposed to do that, all right? And it takes some like experience and so on to find out these things and solve them and not let this happen.
Yeah.
But if you don't pay attention, you may later on understand, well, actually, I wanted to build a tool that helps people, and I might end up actually hurting them more.
Yeah.
Than just send them an email.
Yeah, that's really, really wild, right? And I think that this gets to the core of why people like Elon Musk and others are concerned about AI in the long run, right? Because you might have the greatest intentions with this technology, but because it works sometimes in mysterious ways that takes, as you just said, you know, a while to figure out that it's actually doing not what it is that you, you know, set a goal for, damage has been done. And, you know, here we're talking about, you know, it's still important, but it's at a micro level compared to what could be happening if, as you're saying, you know, the price comes down, it becomes, you know, essentially democratized, where little companies like me and others can take these technologies up really, really quickly and really easily and scale them out. Well, then we're talking about kind of a ubiquitous use of AI across many industries. And if these kinds of problems happen, then it's quite a problematic future, actually.
I mean, it is a serious topic. However, I would like just to say I'm very hopeful at the same time.
Good.
Because I also believe that most of the, like, the situation that I can imagine are situations that I would expect people catch early on. And it can be either the smaller newcomers using these tools themselves, or it could be the providers of these tools understand certain problems are happening.
Mm-hmm.
There can be different profiles of people leading large projects, but at least in my experience, I can tell you that I have yet not met a single machine learning engineer, data scientist, that honestly, as soon as they would find any of these, you know, problems are happening,
mm-hmm.
they wouldn't do their best to fix it immediately, to inform everyone that this is happening, to raise the alarms and you know, stop it as soon as possible.
Yeah. Well, that's really good to hear. That's quite reassuring, because I think, as is the nature of the internet and social media, they need to create more hype. They need to exaggerate claims quite a bit, I think. So it's good to hear a little bit more from somebody who's, you know, practically working on these things. And if you haven't even experienced one case where these things aren't stopped or found, identified, stopped, or at least then worked on, then maybe there's a little bit more hope for AI in the future.
Really. That's good.
I see that our time is winding down. Do you have any other specific points, maybe to the future of AI and how it's going to be implemented in companies, before we wrap up?
Yeah, maybe something that I've been following and found that recently there's been more of a conscious effort, and I found very, very exciting, very, very interesting, is the next step in the processing or understanding of information, meaning not only having systems that give you statistical, like, answers, like the so-called statistical parallels of a chatbot or so on, but really to try to understand how we can give reasoning and planning capabilities in the same neural architectures. There are different approaches, algorithms for these two tasks already. So far, it's really not effective to layer them or stack them as Lego pieces. But there is already a very interesting research in integrating everything. And I think as soon as this comes, it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to have an artificial general intelligence. But it is going to be more generalist than it is. And even if it's a little increment, this can have big implications for many industries. So I'm very, very excited to see what happens there in the next years. Yes.
Very interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Just a little update or improvement to the generalization of some of the generalization capacity of some of these technologies can really have massive ramifications. Interesting. Well, maybe when that actually happens, I'll have to have you back on. We can only touch on what the future of that is actually going to happen and who it's going to impact. Jorge, thanks a lot for coming on. It was really interesting.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing your insights. Where can people follow your work or get in touch with you best if they want to, say, reach out or if they're interested in having AI implemented and adopted into their business?
Yeah, definitely. I'm reachable mostly, I would say, in LinkedIn. Just type my name there. I'm very happy to get in contact with people to understand their thoughts, their questions on their business, but in general, just to talk about these technologies. I've been also lecturing in a couple of universities, and I'm also always very happy to stay in touch, I don't know, with the students, with their thoughts, their ideas, and so on. And it's also very interesting to learn also from people approaching you as well. So yeah. LinkedIn is a great place
for that. Perfect. Yeah. Perfect. I think we should also mention, so we were both connected through Outvize, the talent tech platform. So we both have profiles on there, and if people are already on there, they can definitely reach you through there as well. But I'll have those links in the show notes, and I'll put a little shout out in the introduction that I usually do for these podcasts. So
absolutely. Yes. Now, thank you very much as well for my
support. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate your insights and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mark.
Cheers.
Well, thanks for listening to this week's Future Tech and Foresight podcast. If you like what you've heard here, there are, of course, a number of ways that you can support the podcast. The best way would be to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or give a rating on Spotify, which you can find a step-by-step explanation for on the futuretechandforesight.com website. Alternatively, feel free to leave a comment either on the episode show notes or the YouTube channel where you can see video recordings of the interviews. And finally, if you are part of an organization that is aware of the disruptive and transformational impact that emerging and future technologies will bring and want to know more, please get in touch to hear about the strategic foresight services that we offer and how we can help future-proof your organization and take advantage of the phenomenal opportunities available to survive and thrive in the future.
A lot of future shock people and future shocked institutions in our society are simply overwhelmed.
Once there is superintelligence, the fate of humanity may depend on what the superintelligence does.
Science fact is catching up to science fiction.
The first truly intelligent machine will be the last invention that humanity needs to make.
The only scarcity that will exist in the future is that which we decide to create ourselves as humans.
Within a 10-year design revolution, we can have all humanity living the highest and living anybody's ever known.
Progress is accelerating at an exponential pace, and it's going to reach a point where progress is so fast, it's going to be a singularity.
We are probably one of the last generations of Homo sapiens.
Every single headline points to the birth pangs of a Type 1 civilization.